Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to this podcast from the OIES China Energy Program. My name is Anders Hovey, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute. On the 8th of August, 2023, the China Program published an issue of the Oxford Energy Forum on the geopolitics of energy and China. This podcast is a part of a series drawing on the very rich OEF contributions. The aim of the forum was to think about China's role in the geopolitics of energy, both fossil fuels and new energy supply chains, both from China's perspective and the view from other regions around the world. Today's podcast, the third in our series, features a discussion among three contributors about the topic of Chinese dominance of critical minerals and supply chains. I'm speaking with Patrick Schroeder, Senior Research Fellow in the Environment and Society Program at Chatham House, Henry Sanderson, Executive Editor at Benchmark Mineral Intelligence, and Philip Andrew Speed, Senior Research Fellow at OIES. Thank you all so much for joining today. Henry, I wondered if you could just help us set the stage with some of the top-level numbers on Chinese dominance of critical minerals for the energy transition, especially the critical minerals used in lithium-ion batteries and wind permanent magnets, but there are other critical minerals and other technologies as well. Which are the minerals we should be most concerned about?
If you look at China's dominance in the lithium-ion battery supply chain, it really has a very dominant position in the processing of the minerals and then turning these minerals into battery precursors, cathodes and anodes, and then batteries. All these different stages that happen before it gets into a lithium-ion battery and then goes into your vehicle. And China has not only managed to build up a huge industry, it's also expanding rapidly. And they've also made batteries cost-effective. The reason lithium-ion batteries have come down in cost is part of China's dominance. And there are some minerals where China's dominance is very extreme, I would say. So graphite, you know, China produces and processes almost 100% of the graphite, which is used in the battery anode. And it's actually very critical for fast charging of batteries. And something like manganese as well, almost all of the manganese is processed in China. And cobalt as well, almost all the cobalt from the Democratic Republic of Congo is processed in China. But in my mind, I think we should pay attention to graphite, to manganese, these areas where China's 90%+, right? Because when we talk about de-risking, these are surely, you know, areas where we need to reduce some of that market share.
Philip, in your piece, you trace some of the history of Chinese dominance of critical minerals. What specific advantages did China have that enabled this dominance to come about in the first place?
Well, the key really lay in the willingness and the ability of the government to provide support to industries along the full length of the supply chain, from mining through processing to the manufacturing of final products. And this has been going on for a long time. The rare earth elements are probably the most spectacular example, with the first mine production in Mongolia in the 1950s, then discoveries of heavy rare earths in clays in the south. By 1975, the state council had established a national rare earth development and application leading group. And so over the following decades, this support for R&D and industrial expansion from mining and processing and manufacturing just grew, and it became a major exporter of rare earth metals and ores. This was, it was even importing beneficiated ores for processing from other countries, such as the US. All of this was, of course, aided not just by government policy, but by a mix of low safety and environmental standards, which now are largely addressed. And over the last decade or so, we can see a similar story for other metals, such as Henry's mentioned, cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, but with the key difference that in many cases, China is actually importing the ores in order to process and then manufacture into products. And this is, yeah, this is industrial policy and what we might call national security policy. So yes, we build the industries, but we also make sure we have enough of the processed metals in order to we don't have to import them or the final products.
Patrick, in your piece, you discuss some of the approaches that are being tried, especially in Europe, to reduce dependence or diversify supplies of critical minerals. Could you tell us what some of those are?
In Europe, and one of the approaches in that we're also looking at in our research is the role of the circular economy and specifically recycling. And recycling is an important approach to reduce criticality of materials, and will become even more important in the future, especially after 2030. So in terms of policy, the European Critical Raw Materials Act has an overarching target for recycling that by 2030, 15% of the EU's annual consumption of what's called strategic raw materials should be met by EU recycling capacity. And at the moment, the recycling rates for some critical materials are very low. For example, for the rare earth metals, for some of these, it's like 0%. For others, it's quite high. Platinum, for example, has very high recycling rates. And large factor for this is the cost and the price. So rare earth metals are very, very cheap in terms of the primary materials. If the cost of recycling is too high, then obviously there's no economic case for doing that. But there are companies now in Europe moving into recycling of different materials. But even here, they're facing competition with China because China already has established recycling and processing for a number of materials. So yeah, that's a challenge for European companies that want to establish themselves. And beyond recycling, the circular economy, we think, is quite important because it includes a number of other aspects as well, in terms of looking also at how products are designed. Are they designed in a way that enables easy recovery of the materials? Are they designed in a way that they can be repaired or remanufactured? So the circular economy, in a way, is important to shift the discussion from also how do we secure more resources? How do we design smarter systems that do not rely on constant new throughput of non-renewable resources? And also, how do we utilize the materials that have already been mined, are in use, and what do we make of the stocks that we're producing?
And Patrick, staying on that topic of recycling also depends on supply. And right now, of course, the supply of some batteries and other clean energy materials are just scaling up. What's the time frame for recycling to really start having an effect on the supply and demand of these critical minerals?
It's important already for some materials, but it's important to make the decisions now, because setting up recycling facilities as well as the logistics and value chains for these also takes time. So that needs to be done in parallel with, as we anticipate, end-of-life batteries, end-of-life PV panels, etc., to come reach the end of life. So that's important also for the investments to go into these new value chains. So 2030, I think, is an important date, again, not only because it's been set by the Commission, but also some of the projections of when there will be kind of a large stock of end-of-life energy technologies that are available for more large-scale recycling operations.
Now, what progress has been made in terms of striking supply deals with other countries, and what are the prospects for increasing this trend?
Yes, there have been a number of critical minerals deals that the EU has conducted with other countries, for example, Canada, Kazakhstan, Namibia, even Ukraine. There are negotiations underway for free trade agreements with countries such as Chile, Argentina, DRC in Africa. And these deals address market access, investment protection, but also sustainable sourcing of critical materials. I interestingly attended an event in Brussels at the Swiss embassy recently, where the Chilean ambassador also spoke about their lithium industry and the European partnership that they're trying to expand. And one of the key aspects of how Chile sees this strategic partnership to develop, that should create more local added value in Chile, rather than Chile being purely a country where materials are extracted and then exported. So the partner countries are also looking for new industries in this value chain. They don't just want to be at the very beginning. That means also investments in processing potentially need to be made into these countries.
Now, Philip, turning to the United States, I think everybody listening is aware of the Inflation Reduction Act. But specifically, what is the U.S. doing to reduce its dependence and boost domestic production and processing of critical minerals?
Well, you could say that in the Western world, the US is the leader in taking actions. And of course, it, together with Canada, has this advantage of having a large and established domestic mining industry. And they just need to get it going in the right directions. But even before the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, the government had already blocked defense contractors from buying Chinese rare earths. And the departments of defense and energy were already investing in the rare earth supply chain. Then, of course, came the Inflation Reduction Act with incentives for producing certain critical minerals and also targets for the percentage of battery materials that should come from the US or from free trade agreement partners. In addition, stockpiles are being built up, not just of ores and metals, but also of intermediate goods such as permanent magnets. As a result of all this, investment in mining, processing, and recycling of critical minerals is increasing. And also, on the other side, research into reducing the requirement for some of these minerals in the final products, such as minerals for batteries and permanent magnets, where hopefully you can use less rare earth metals or less strong magnets, or magnets and batteries of completely different compositions.
Henry, coming back to China, China is not standing still on this topic of critical minerals either. You write that China seeks to sustain and even increase its dominance of critical minerals. What's the motivation for that? And what specifically is China doing to expand or maintain its dominance in these key fields?
Yeah, so if you think about China's economy, obviously they need as many jobs at the moment as they can get. And they've built this huge industrial supply chain, clean energy supply chain. So they need to feed this supply chain as it expands with a constant source of critical minerals. If they don't get access to supplies of critical minerals, their whole supply chain is useless. So they need to make sure in an increasingly hostile world that they can access supplies. So that's why we've seen Chinese companies investing heavily in Africa, even looking at Afghanistan for lithium, and investing heavily in Argentina and Chile. So they're building up these future supplies. And in a way, they have a lot of advantages because, as I say, they have the expertise in the processing. And as was just mentioned, a lot of these countries want to also move up the value chain. And so the Chinese are the ones that can do it. So in return for access to raw materials, they can help provide processing, perhaps in country as well. So China needs to feed the machine. At the same time, Xi Jinping in China is keen that the Western world become more reliant on Chinese supply chains at the same time as China tries to reduce its reliance. And China also wants to export the final product, the electric vehicle, right? So we've seen electric vehicle exports really increase. But as I say, to sustain that, they need the minerals coming in at the beginning of the supply chain to feed the rest of it. So in some senses, they face a vulnerable situation and they're very reliant on imports.
I'd like to bring you back in on this point. China has occasionally instituted restrictions on exports of critical minerals and variously used such restrictions for commercial, economic, or political purposes. To what extent is the critical minerals weapon effective? Do you see this happening more often in the future? And what's the vulnerability of an individual country as opposed to maybe just the wider effort to diversify or shift clean energy production away from China?
Yes, you're right, Anders. I mean, China imposes quotas, export quotas on many raw materials, actually. And the most prominent of this are the oil products, where every few months it issues quotas for exports. So the practice of quotas for export is not particularly targeted at these critical minerals. But if we go back a decade or so, in 2010, 2011, we saw a sharp reduction in the export quotas for rare earths. Now, officially, this was to help the government bring order to a chaotic domestic rare earth mining and processing industry that was dirty and dangerous. And this action affected all international buyers of rare earth metals, which is where we saw the earliest sort of moves to try and address this dependence of the West on China. More recently, we've seen China restrict exports of gallium and germanium. in response to the US and Europe restricting chip exports to China. So this was a retaliation, not just a one-sided move. Such moves cannot easily target a single country. And we've seen this with gas in the recent issues with the war in Ukraine. However, where trade is through bilateral contracts, then I can imagine that China could favor some countries over others by only allowing its companies to have export contracts with countries A, B, and C. But still, they could then sell it on, maybe. But in general, it's going to be difficult to target a single country rather than the West. So is it likely to continue? Yes, I think China's likely to resort to these tactics for as long as we have these fairly serious trade tensions between China and the West.
Now, Henry, you note that one of the areas of ambiguity in European and North American policy is to what extent China's direct involvement in their own clean energy supply chains inside those regions, or sometimes together with Western companies in other third countries, does that help reduce Chinese dominance in these fields, or is it actually increasing Chinese dominance? What's your view on that?
Yeah, so I think this is one of the areas that we really need to focus on in the West, which is, okay, we accept that China has this dominant position. We're unlikely to, you know, reduce that immediately this decade. So how do we deal with Chinese investment within our borders or, as you say, in third countries? Because the reality is it's happening as we speak. It's happening anyway. And some deals fly above the radar and they get attention in the US, but other deals just are happening under the radar. But the fact is that the Chinese have the expertise, they have the know-how, and the fact is we need to move this energy transition fast. The planet, the climate doesn't care about the West, you know, giving the West time to move down the learning curve and learn how to do these things. We need cost-effective clean energy technologies today, and we need them to expand production 20% a year. My feeling is we need to define our approach to having Chinese investment and what is the best model. Maybe licensing the technology is one model where the Western company maintains ownership of the plant, the project, but we license the Chinese technology. But let's think about how we can get the best deal out of these agreements, because they are going to happen anyway, and they are happening anyway. From the Chinese company's perspective, they're very keen to invest in Europe, US, other countries. They want to expand out of their home market, which is ruthlessly competitive. You know, the Chinese market drives margins down because it's so competitive. So they want to expand to these other markets, and they know they have the expertise. So it's just really Western policy that is limiting that expansion. So I think we need to define, like China did early on when they didn't have the technology, they did joint ventures and other licensing deals. What can we learn so that we can benefit, that they can perhaps train up our people and we can acquire some of the knowledge and technology.
Right. And I should note that the CATL plant in Michigan, if that goes ahead, that is a licensing deal specifically, just as you said. Now, Patrick, for the EU and the US, there are a lot of environmental, social, and governance issues to consider when dealing with critical minerals, and especially when doing contracts with third countries. You write about this security sustainability nexus. Can you tell us why policymakers see this type of nexus emerging, and what does that depend on?
So I came across the term security sustainability nexus in a recent paper by Thierry Francois. The paper was published in the Global Environmental Politics Journal, talked specifically about the context of lithium mining and batteries. But I thought it's also relevant for a number of other of the critical materials more generally. And so this nexus, as it's described, is constituted by an interlocking set of policies and justification that promotes raw material extraction by Western companies and emphasizes the environmental credentials as well as onshoring of processing and manufacturing. And then for policymakers, obviously these onshoring policies that counter China's dominance over the new energy supply chains is attractive. For the mining and maybe auto manufacturing firms, in the case of batteries, the onshoring translates into incentives, supply security, and also reputational benefits. So in the paper, Tia's rather critical of this concept and whether or whether of this approach and whether it can reshape these existing inequalities linked to extractive sectors. I think it's important actually to see that conceptualized, that security and environment and sustainability are linked, I do hope the environmental aspect, sustainability aspect, will not fall aside, because we are then potentially creating these trade-offs with biodiversity, trying to secure all these materials for the energy transition. So sustainability is definitely really important on the same level as this, the security of supply.
And how do you see that playing out? If we do prioritize them, does that ultimately mean that it won't be possible to scale up supplies of critical minerals with the same speed that China can do in these other countries?
Yeah, this is a really good question. And I'm not sure if I have the right answer. So implementing ESG and with high standards for working conditions and looking at the environmental impacts of mining, all that probably takes more time in terms of permitting, probably also more expensive to do these things. So are we ready to pay the additional costs for ESG? And then, yeah, again, can we do this if, for example, Chinese mining companies do not follow these ESG principles, or other countries' mining enterprises? So there's the danger that then it becomes a race to the bottom, where that all falls by the wayside, and it's just whoever provides the cheapest access will share, get the market dominance, etc.
I can imagine that focusing on ESG from the beginning also helps reduce risks of the project shutting down prematurely or experiencing some other kind of serious disaster after it's already started. So, you know, when you're starting, of course, speed seems most essential, but after you're done with the project launch, then of course you still have risks of ESG. I'd like to end the podcast by asking each of you to evaluate the prospects for reducing China's dominance of critical minerals. Starting with you, Henry, you seem most pessimistic, writing that you expect Western countries to remain in a weak position on critical minerals. What are the reasons for that?
Yeah, I think at least, you know, this decade, as I say, you know, China's dominance in some sectors like graphite, manganese, others, where you've got, you know, 90%+, 100%, we're not going to change that overnight. So I think at least this decade into the early 2030s, it will be difficult. But we do see, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act as a landmark climate legislation. The EU's drafted similar legislation. But I think what we need to see in the West is the staying power. We need to see these policies sustained, right, over many years. And something like mining is a very long-term business. And if we're talking about actually building mines in the US and Europe, we need to see that, you know, the policy is sustained and the public's willing to deal with that. So, and then the processing side, yes, we have all this money flowing in the US now, but still there's a question of cost. It's still an inflationary environment. Interest rates are still high. So all these tricky challenges, can we actually process and produce these materials at a cost-effective manner? So that's still a challenge. The energy transition is a huge task. So we can't expect to just cut out China from tomorrow. So I think, yes, this decade we are in a relatively weak position. But saying that, if policy is sustained, if it's not reversed, if we get the public on side, then I think the West stands a real chance to build up our own industries and definitely be risked by the 2030s.
Philip, do you agree with Henry? You wrote that efforts to reduce vulnerability may have reached a turning point.
Yes, I mean, by that, I meant the efforts may have reached a turning point. The policies seem to have reached a turning point. And again, it's interesting to go back to 2012 in reaction to the China's export quotas on rare earths, because a number of governments, the US included and Japan, sort of started to introduce policies and this and that, but then it all went away as eventually China started exporting more, prices came down, panic went away. So to go back to Henry's point, yeah, these policies need to be sustained. That is absolutely critical. Then we're in with a chance during the 2030s of having significantly reduced dependence on China. But again, going back to earlier comments, possibly working with China in our own countries in manufacturing.
Right, a lot of agreement so far. Patrick, can I ask you, do you agree with everything that Henry and Philip have said so far?
Yes, I tend to agree also that in terms of the time scale, it will take sustained effort over time to address that dominance, so it won't happen overnight. So 2030, yeah, is probably a good date to focus on. And this is, again, also where the policies I think focus towards. And maybe just to emphasize again what I said before, I think in terms of industrial strategy, the European Union has the Circular Economy Action Plan and the European Green Deal. So if we link critical raw materials within this wider concept of circularity transitions, I think that's a really good approach to address these multiple issues around securing access, not only to primary resources, but also secondary materials, which become more important over time as stocks build up. I think supporting also what Philip and Henry are saying, it's a long-term transition and long-term strategies that need to be sustained over time.
Thank you so much, Patrick, Henry, and Philip. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining me and for your contributions to the forum. A reminder to our listeners that the Oxford Energy Forum on China and the Geopolitics of Energy is available on our website. We hope you'll enjoy reading it and listening to the other podcasts on this fascinating topic.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.